Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of consciousness and who we are as evolving beings. And we seem to be right now at a crossroads in consciousness. So hopefully tonight's guests will be able to show us a clear path through this wilderness. I'm talking tonight to Stephen Larson. He's a psychologist, and he's also a founding board. He's on the founding board of advisors to the Joseph Campbell Foundation, also the founder of the Center for Symbolic Studies, and a student of Joseph Campbell's work. Welcome, Stephen. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Alan, for giving such due diligence to consciousness.
Well, I think that's all we got is consciousness, isn't it? That's all there. It seems.
Well,
like,
you know.
Yeah.
As a practicing, professional psychotherapist and psychology professor for many years, I was told again and again that consciousness cannot be defined. And it's one of those bugbears in the face of modern technologically inspired social science that they can't define consciousness, and yet everybody's got it.
Right. But something seems to be doing something, right? I mean, there's obviously... Well, that's part of the problem we're in now, because we can't define consciousness in terms of an old paradigm, but there's a new culture that's emerging that includes consciousness almost as a substitute for God. Would you say that's true in your analysis?
Neither concept is very well understood.
Right.
So you could substitute one wild card for another over time. And I think that one thing that we do know is that human beings who can report upon their internal states can evidence a kind of consciousness about it. Mm. What's a little harder to define is whether, let's say, animals have consciousness. And any pet owner, I think, would say affirmatively that animals have consciousness. There was an old FBI interrogation expert back in the 1970s named Cleve Baxter, who attached skin galvanometers to plants, and he swore that plants could respond to human emotions or the death of brine shrimp when dropped into pots of boiling water, all kinds of things. So one of the ways that one elucidates consciousness is the ability to respond to stimuli.
Mm. Well,
or the ability.
Yeah,
go ahead.
No, I mean, in a way, we can say that's awareness. I mean, consciousness perhaps is the awareness of awareness. I mean, maybe that's but we can go on and on like that. I think really, I mean, because it's a philosophical situation that has yet to be defined. And I think what we're coming to in terms of our culture are new ways of defining these ideas. I mean, this is what I'll be talking to Stephen and a few other people about on Thursday night at the Meta Center. That's May 16th at the Meta Center in New York. You go to my website, newrealities.com, to get the details. But that's really is what I'm trying to understand, at least from you, in terms of mythic thinking, is that we are changing. We are really coming into a new way of thinking. And I love your book, The Fundamentalist Mind, because it kind of maps out in a way where we've been and what the pitfalls of where we can be. So are you getting that sense too, that we are reconstructing these myths in a new way? I mean, does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I think that, well, and learning to think about consciousness in a new way. One of my favorite psychologists of all time is William James, and it was William James who first announced the idea of altered states of consciousness. And though he began that at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, it was not until the latter part of the 20th century that altered states of consciousness became a really popular pastime.
Right.
Call it a hobby, yeah, a hobby for some people. And it was, you know, our ordinary consciousness is but one type of consciousness, whilst all about it parted by the filmiest of screens lie untapped forms of consciousness. I'm paraphrasing James a little bit there.
But wasn't he talking about his nitrous oxide experience when he was referring to
Well,
that?
And many other things. He was a pioneer, not only in nitrous oxide, but in getting a hold of peyote cactus. And by modifying consciousness, you see that it is a kind of a plastic commodity, if you will. It can be manipulated mechanically by stage hypnotists and media moguls, and also by great and high art. When we are inspired by a piece of music or by a piece of visual art, the mind leaps to new levels of insight and compass. And I think that's just an amazing experience. And people who are satisfied with the pedestrian supermarket and gas station consciousness haven't peeked into those other realms. And those other realms are really marvels. And we learn about ordinary consciousness by going into these altered states of consciousness. But unfortunately, the youth of today are almost like compulsively diving headlong into altered states of consciousness without safety gear and without diving helmets and so on. And sometimes it's kind of hard to get them back.
Right. But would you say, as far as altered states of consciousness, that there is no medium, there's no bar set for what consciousness actually is? So maybe what we're experiencing now or in this time is an altered state of consciousness compared to what someone else may have experienced 100 years ago.
Possibly so, because the media and the access to tools for conscious exploration, I've often said that the...
Yeah.
Telescope and the microscope changed our consciousness because they allowed us to peer visually into realms that before were invisible. You couldn't see a paramecium from your pond scum wiggling under a microscope, or look out into deep space like the Hubble telescope can do and go, wow, this is breathtaking. Like, I didn't know my consciousness could encompass such wonders. And so if we think that the only... Yeah, go ahead.
No, that's where I'm going with this kind of discussion, is that it's what McLuhan said, that the mediums that we use to communicate are the mediums of consciousness, in a sense. So we are remaking our consciousness now in terms of a digital media. I mean, look at what we're doing right now. I mean, talking over Skype, that is.
Yes, there was a book by Piers Anthony, I think it was, called Macroscope, that there was a kind of an amazing cosmic machine that could kind of tap into any reality and show it to you, and you could kind of enter that. And it seems like every time we go on the internet, we're looking into the macroscope now in a certain kind of sense. It's amazing how quickly we can tune into not only information, but imaginative productions and dramas and music. It's all right there. This was inconceivable 25 years ago.
Right. And it's hard to know. I mean, we don't notice our own growth, but could it be when we were a television population in the 60s that we were actually thinking differently than we are now, when we are, in a sense, much more multidimensional? We have these ideas and we can access so much information. Are we, in essence, different beings? I mean, I'm just throwing that as a question.
Well, you know, and you wanted to talk about Joseph Campbell, so I'll...
Yes, I do.
I'll talk about him just a little bit. Joseph would say that the human brain, with its 10 billion neurons and untold trillions of possibilities of synaptic connections and stuff like that. That's still the hardware. Culture and myth and information and art are the software. And that's where it's really happening. But we have to have good hardware to get access to the software, and we have to have good software to make the hardware interesting at all. And so culture is expanding at amazing kind of rates and blowing open new possibilities. On the other hand, you know, as McLuhan found out, people are getting lazy, and a lot of people don't know how to read or read in depth or systematically read anymore. And the print-oriented culture goes in and out. I mean, sometimes it's restricted these days to kids texting each other, and there are amazing statistics on how much texting goes on. Now, is texting increasing our consciousness or decreasing it? I don't know. Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, it always looks sort of downward to the older generation, who thinks that the younger generation should know what they know, you know, that texting is a deep degradation of the system. But I think something else is happening that we have yet to see. And I think Joseph Campbell, and I'd love for you to talk more about him, because Stephen was a student of Joseph Campbell, but in his book, and you talk about the inner reaches of outer space, what I know about that book, he comes to some overview of a cosmic scale. And can you talk about that in terms of these new ideas?
Well, I remember when he wrote that book, published it. It was just a couple of years before he died. And he took his attention away from the encyclopedic historical atlas of world mythology that he had been working on for many years. And suddenly, at this point, Joseph Campbell was in touch with the cutting edge of the transforming culture. I mean, he was going to Grateful Dead concerts. He was being interviewed by Bill Moyers, the earlier set of interviews, and then the later set. And he was appreciating the new media. My wife, Robin, and I talked him into getting a computer. And he called us back and he said, "My computer, I'm calling it Yahweh." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, it's all rules and no mercy.
That's funny.
He was right. Yeah. But Campbell's definition still holds that not culture and mythology are the software, and they are amazing carriers of information. And I do want to say something for classical scholarship and learning as many human languages as you can and mastering fields of knowledge, because unless you've done that, your knowledge is condemned to superficiality. And I'm afraid that does indeed happen. I mean, there are lots of people who think that, Madonna is a film star, not a painting that hangs in museums or a mythical mother of God, you know. I think our view of reality is deeper as our brains are more exercised and deeper.
Right. Well, that's why you say it in your book. We all can think mythically, but we've been flat. I mean, you don't say that, but we've sort of been flattened by the culture. But you do say we can all think in these mythic proportions, which is really symbolic, which is about functioning on many levels of consciousness at once, in a sense.
Well, yeah. And I think that minds are like parachutes. They work best when they're open. Campbell was really worried about, he predicted the conflict of the three great monotheisms of our time. That is to say, Judaism and Christianity and Islam in terms of, cultural historical appearance. And that the three of them would be duking it out in the 21st century. I mean, he saw that coming. He talks about that in The Inner Reaches of Outer Space. And Campbell's own preference, as I think mine is for the multicolored rainbow cultural effect of the polytheisms, because we don't need to mistake our representations of God for God.
That's a really good point. And that's where the fundamentalist falls down, because that's exactly it, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So the three great monotheisms, they have one thing that is their idea of God, and it's monolithic in its emotional and spiritual implications. And if you say anything against my idea of God, I'm going to kill you. And that's really, I mean, you look at Western civilization, it's been going on for a long time. Holy wars are, they predominate.
Well, Eastern civilization, too, the Bhagavad Gita is a holy war that, I think it's just the nature of humanity, or the old nature of humanity, to become fundamental with when you don't have knowledge of who we really are. And I think that's really what you're trying to say in that book, A Fundamentalist Mind. We need to expand what we know ourselves to be, in a sense.
Well, yeah. I say that in that book, that there is an emerging humanity that is not limited by a convention of God and heaven and the supernatural realms, that that the idea of God does have to, and I think Campbell would endorse this fully, the idea of God has to expand as our ability to conceive of him, that is, as our consciousness expands.
Right, and that's really where I want to go in our discussion on Thursday, and see that possibility from many points of view. So, I mean, but can you expand on that? Because in a sense, wasn't that always the case? I mean, it's not just the case now in our history. That was always true of us, wasn't it?
You mean limited ideas of God or
Yeah, I mean, the possibility that God truly is beyond the fixed ideas that we have put on this concept that we're calling God. I mean, the search for meaning is the search for who we are in relationship to what we're calling God, in that sense.
Campbell would often quote Meister Eckhart, a medieval theologian, who said the ultimate leave-taking is of God for God. That is, the ultimate leave-taking is of our idea of what God is or must be for, and this is another phrase that Campbell loved, the mysterium tremendum et fascinans. It was coined by the religionist Rudolf Otto in The Idea of the Holy, I think it's translated, his book was translated,
yeah.
that if we can really condition ourselves to look at the great and holy mystery that the universe is every place that we look, from the simplest cellular animals to the galaxies of outer space and stuff like that, there is a great and beautiful mystery unfolding before our experience. And if you can expand your mind that much, you're going to have a good time of living.
Right, and that's why he said follow your bliss, because his mind was expanded. Can you just talk about, I mean, we'll get back to our conversation, but I'm just curious about Joseph Campbell himself. I know we're jumping around a little bit. But did he truly live that way as a person? Because you hung out with him.
We hung out with him quite a bit. And follow your bliss is an unfortunately, pared down version of a much more powerful idea that he believed in and that he held. Campbell would say that a midlife crisis is you've spent your life, at least the first half of your life, climbing up a ladder, and you get to the top, and then you find it's against the wrong wall.
That's funny.
So you have to start all over again, and that's also called a paradigm shift or a paradigm change. But I think what he was saying is that you have to allow – he didn't say, follow your narcissism, or he didn't say follow your pleasure. He said follow your bliss, which is your ability to immerse yourself unreservedly in experience and in the nature of life and of living. And if you do that, you won't be disappointed. And to the very end of his days, I mean, Campbell lived that way. He, in some ways, people would say he lived a very conventional life. He died walking to his writing desk. But he was living in Waikiki Beach in Honolulu last 5 years of his life, and he kind of retired there. He kept his apartment in New York. But he was living there, and every day he would go out into the Pacific Ocean. And this was after his death. I tried to duplicate one of his quarter-mile swims in the open Pacific Ocean and found it was extremely daunting because there were riptides out there, and the ocean was pretty choppy, and you had to be a mighty man indeed to swim in those seas.
So he would swim into his 80s into the ocean. Is that what you would say?
He was swimming, yes, in his 80s. He would swim when he lived in New York. He would swim in the New York Athletic Club pool, and he would do a quarter mile or a half mile, sometimes a mile of swimming, and he would recite the major arcana of the tarot as every time he turned a lap in the pool, he would entertain one of those archetypes in his mind.
So, but did he live in that state? I mean, he really opened up the Western mind to looking at their ideas, I think, their ideas of religion and fundamentalism in a whole new way. And he was such a scholar. But did he live in a kind of altered state of consciousness, would you say? Or was he?
No, I mean, he didn't.
We create a myth out of him.
He didn't live in a nirvikalpa samadhi, but he knew all about it. He lived in a relatively circumscribed environment. He would write for hours every day. He would read and acquire information so that he could write. He would swim, and all the way through his 70s and into his 80s, he was exercise. Somebody once said, "What is your yoga, Joseph Campbell?" And he said, "Red meat, Irish whiskey, and 40 laps a day in the pool."
Wow. No. But was he happy? I guess I'm asking you that. Was he content with his life? Was he satisfied and joyful in his, or did he have problems like everyone else? I guess I'm asking you that.
Well, of course he had problems like everyone
okay,
else.
Okay, so yeah.
We all live in a social matrix, and yet he really was blissful and joyful, and to spend time with him was always, always pleasurable and always revelatory. And we would get into something really exciting. Either we were reading some new thing and we would tell him about it, and he'd say, "Oh, that's funny, I didn't know about that." And it was amazing that you could find anything that he didn't know about. And then he would tell us 10 things that he knew about that we didn't know about. So it was really quite wonderful in that way. He, in some of his later years, he was kind of politically conservative. In his 20s, he went through a sort of a radicalized phase in which everybody was to be a communist. Mm. And then he got disenchanted by the Stalin regime. And then he decided that that Soviet communism and then Maoist communisms were really systematic political systems to destroy human free will. Mm. And so he was kind of anti-communist. But ultimately, he finally said, when he saw the Republican Party's platform on the environment and on women, he just finally said, "Oh, the whole damn thing should go to hell," and he wouldn't vote. He said, it's ridiculous. It's polarized. And he was really, yes, of course, he would go through periods of depression. I mean, Richard Nixon was president in his last years, and he, at that point, had been a voting Republican because he didn't want to see the country turn to communism. And then he had to behold the specter of McCarthyism, and then he had to behold what Nixon tried to get away with.
Oh, I see. But the legacy that he left was a reorientation, at least for me. I mean, that woke me up. It's like, wow, I can look at these stories in religion in terms of who I am and what I think and in my own life, and they're all lessons for the for the human mind to contemplate in their evolution towards awakening. That's what it seems to me.
Well, I would think so. My wife Robin is sitting here with me on Skype.
And hi, Robin.
Hi there. How are you?
And she knew him every bit as well as I did, and she is no slouch in terms of explaining him. Robin, did you have something to say?
Yeah, I'd
that?
Love to hear. Just feel free to jump in anytime, Robin. But yeah, what do you have to say about Joseph Campbell?
I was just feeling that you were kind of looking for the place where the kind of energy that he expressed when we were around him. And I would say that to the very last period of his life, he was capable of just inspiring and exciting a group of people. He was exciting to be around. To go to dinner with Joe would mean conversations that set you sort of buzzing. It turned on your creativity. You left his presence thinking about things to write and to paint and to dance and to create. You went away energized. Mm. And he did that for people. And so he did have a, you know, like anyone, he would be upset about something, he'd be angry about something, but he was often joyful and really, really inspiring to be around.
Would you say that his consciousness had reached that kind of expanded state because of, something like that? I mean, I'm asking.
I do think he had achieved a kind of beautiful grace, a sort of poise in his life. Joe was physically graceful. He was a fine dancer. He was always an athlete, and you saw it to the end of his days. And I think his athleticism also extended to his intelligence, so that he did achieve a kind of dancer's grace in his intellectual and emotional life.
And his wife was a dancer, wasn't she?
Yes, beautiful dancer.
Is she still alive, his wife? Is she still around?
Yes, she is, and she's 97 or 98 years old, lives in Honolulu still.
Oh.
Same apartment that they always lived in. Jean Erdman, a wonderful, wonderful dancer and understudy of Martha Graham.
Mm-hmm. So, Robin, I'm asking then, in terms of like the Campbell understanding, are we in a new phase of creating new myths in this kind of strange in-between time we're living in now?
That was one of the things that Joe, and Steve can quote him better than I can on this, but he said that we couldn't predict the myths of the time we're going into, but there would be changes. I think the place where he felt his most important impact was in the arts, and he felt the most gratification when artists responded to his work, because he felt that we're in a time when priests and religious systems and even intellectual systems have given way to the leadership of the arts. That was something that he really celebrated, that the artists were carrying the torch of consciousness. It was a more open and indeed a more mythic consciousness that is more fluid, more subtle. This is the leading edge, not what you find in every day, but the capability of more people to live out on that edge where once only, the few really remarkable intellectuals could live. And people were persecuted and burned for being troubadours. So in the 12th century, which is a high point in many ways. But what he was seeing was an opening all over the world for the possibilities of the imagination and possibilities for the spirit. Even in the political world, I think we have seen possibilities for at least nearly peaceful revolution just popping up all over the world. Not always successful, not always remaining peaceful, but just people have this in their imagination. This is something new.
Well, it's sort of that started with Martin Luther King, in a sense, that kind of peaceful revolution that did have an impact. But as far as the arts, I think kind of building on the 60s revolution in the arts, people can use the arts to be more human. Where that's how we are maturing into a new civilization, I feel, by feeling more, by being more empathic, more in touch with the whole of humanity. I mean, you know, something happens in a small town in Connecticut and then everyone around the world is immediately moved by that. I think that says something about a new global consciousness.
I think you're right. And I think the internet is the central nervous system, if you will. And we can witness both heaven and hell on the internet. I mean, when I turn on the news or when I turn on even some kinds of kind of imaginative expression, there is just much, much more possibility that is available to us than was 50 years ago, certainly. And I think this might be, Alan, what you were getting at before. Does the internet change our consciousness? I think undoubtedly it does. But I think there are a lazy man's way of using it and the smart man's or woman's way of using it. That is to say, it offers us so many possibilities that it's like being in a an unbelievable supermarket of ideas and possibilities. And one of the things that Campbell used to say is the mystic swims in the same ocean that the schizophrenic drowns in.
Right.
That is to say that universal swirling ocean of consciousness that we all live in, the genuine mystic, and I think this includes the modern cultural creative, has symbolic muscles, that is, and pretty good lungs and pretty good condition, and can swim in those oceans that the casualties of our culture just kind of throw up their arms and drown and don't know what to do.
Did you have something else there?
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to comment that any new technology, even fire, you know, when that came about, you could use that for the good, warming, cooking your food, or for burning down houses. I think each technology, each innovation of the mind has those two sides to it. I mean, look at writing. When writing came in, I'm sure the old school would say, now you don't have to remember anything. Now that there goes our oral tradition, except if you're barking.
Yes, that is a hypervigilant sheepdog at the door. Could you put him out the door so he can? That's our little Australian shepherd Gandalf. If you look at one of my neurofeedback books or our website, stonemountaincenter.com, you will learn the story of Gandalf, who was a rescued sheepdog. He was kept in a crate for a year, lying in his own feces, and he was a terribly freaked out animal. And we basically healed him with neurofeedback. We opened up his opened up his brain and delivered flexibility back to it again. Now he's barking at gremlins in the night.
So you are, I mean, if we talk about the nervous system and the internet and see those both sides to the story, and where do you see, if you could look into the future, where is it leading us? I mean, where is it all going?
The next mythology, as Campbell would say, cannot be predicted. No, close that door. There we go. Cannot be predicted any more than tonight's dream, because a mythology is not an ideology. It is not something experienced with the brain but projected from the heart. So Campbell felt that in a way it was almost really selling something short, selling the mythic imagination, selling the creative human spirit short to say, I know what the next myth is going to be. None of us does. It's kind of bursting forth from all of us in a sense at the same time. And there's no limit. The future is, in a sense, kind of limitless for human beings right now. And, you know, getting back to that idea of the mystic swimming in the same seas that the schizophrenic drowns in, there are lots and lots of cultural casualties. All you have to do is turn on the media, and you see horrible things, and you see wonderful things.
Right. But yeah, that's true. But as far as the new myths, I was just going to say there are new symbols, like what you said, the symbol of the internet, or the internet as a symbol of consciousness, is sort of a new thing within, you know, the field of humanity. And so I guess, like, if we look at what are these new cultural ideas or ideals or symbols that are now presenting itself to us, we can possibly see a direction. Does that make sense as a symbol?
Well, I do believe so, because it does. It is a metamorphic plastic symbol. That means it hasn't taken a solidified form. And that's the problem with fundamentalism, is that somebody has taken a crystallized, frozen form of the unfathomable mystery, venerated it, turned it into an idol, and then vowed to punish anybody who doesn't worship your idol. And I think that's a big, big mistake. And that also is talking about how the mind must be kept flexible, plastic, and open. And we have to train ourselves in these ways. We have to have a, you know, mens sana in corpore sano. We have to have a sane mind in a healthy body. Our minds have to be flexible, open, healthy, fed on nourishing matter. And the bodies have to be the same thing. Our bodies have to be nurtured organically, exercised in clean, fresh air, given clean water to drink. And then you can, there's a possibility of a sane mind and a healthy body.
I think so. And there's probably tools that you can line out for people of how to do that. I just want to throw out another idea to you and Robin too. Are we thinking collectively more because of something like the internet? Are we inextricably bound to another in a ways that we haven't before, or am I mythicizing the internet itself?
Well, you know, the popular meaning of myth Joseph used to love this thing that he got from a quote from Robert Johnson, the Jungian analyst. Johnson asked a room full of people, what is a myth? And a 10-year-old boy raised his hand and he said, let's see, a myth is something that's a lie on the outside, but it's true on the inside.
Wow, a 10-year-old boy said that?
Yeah.
That's incredible.
And Campbell used to quote that, and you know, we could be talking about Indra's net of gems with the internet. You know, Campbell used to talk about this wonderful image from Hindu mythology about Indra had a net in which all of the conscious beings of the universe were like gems in this vast spiderweb-like net, and it's spread throughout. And we have to regard each human being that we meet, that wonderful tradition they have in India of going, Namaste, I recognize God within you. That is to say, within the facets of your crystalline self, I can see God.
So maybe you're saying some myths are becoming more predominant in a way as reflecting the collective culture at some point. You know, maybe all the myths are out there, all the permutations of what human consciousness can be have been laid out in these mythic stories, except some become more familiar to where we are at certain times in our history.
Well, Campbell expanded our library of scripts. If you were raised, let's say, in Christianity like I was, you had a, you know, you have the Bible, which is a vast and comprehensive book assembled by many authors in many different times and places. Is it the revealed word of God? You have to really stretch yourself to say that. But it's, there's a lot of richness in there, wonderful stories in the Old Testament and in the and the New Testament, and that marvelous madcap book of Revelations that St. John penned there. But I love having the Bhagavad Gita, the Panka Tantra, the Hadith, the lore of the Zulu Sangomas at my fingertips, because the soul expands with its own vocabulary of symbols. In other words, we have a much vaster, more intricate web of symbolic imagery and narratives available to us than people ever had before. I mean, you know, America was founded on religious freedom, but you had the choice of about three different variants of Christianity, and that was it.
Right, and there was not much freedom after that, so I see.
Well, there,
yeah.
Yeah, but now we have these narratives, and America is indeed a melting pot. America is indeed, you know, we are having African people who bring their Yoruba and Zulu and Ife knowledge base and traditions to us, and we all can kind of drink that stuff in and eat it like a kind. It's like going out to a you know, a wonderful Indian restaurant or an Ethiopian restaurant or a Chinese restaurant. You know, when I was a kid growing up, I mean, a Chinese restaurant was like a an unbelievable wonder that people could eat stuff like that instead of meat and potatoes. Right. And our culture has been based on meat and potatoes. And now we have, you know, sweet and sour, whatever.
But that must have been a new mythic ideal, in a sense, or a new configuration within the human consciousness, the idea of America being a melting pot and taking all these cultures from all over the world and mixing them together into this Americana type. That was new. That was an added feature to the conscious landscape.
Yes, and America loomed in the consciousness of the 17th, 18th, 19th century as a sort of a paradigm of what the world of the future could be. America is a city built upon a hill. It was compared to the Holy Jerusalem, the heavenly city of God, where all races and all people could come together in amicable and mutually supportive ways. And I think at its best, America is like that. And then you have the old guard and the old conservatives saying, no, this isn't the America I thought it was, you know. There are people from all over the place in all different colors and sizes and shapes and varieties. Oh, my God, this is not America as I knew it.
Well,
sorry.
Yeah.
It is changing. Yeah.
It is. I mean, but it did hold that ideal that was – that did represent a kind of unification of consciousness in this and a new world. And what I'm just hypothesizing is that maybe the internet itself is a kind of new liberation for the planet, if it's used to its best way to support the evolution of consciousness.
I think there is absolutely no question about that. And the internet must not be censored or tampered with by governments in any way. It is a vast leavening field that allows, you know, Chinese kids to talk to American kids, to talk to Middle Eastern kids, and levels the playing field and introduces people to other cultures, other ways of knowing, other ways of being, and imaginative stuff too. So I would not like to see the internet censored or curtailed.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. You know, another aspect of your book, The Fundamentalist Mind, which I'm really enjoying, is you talk about Julian James and the breakdown of the bicameral mind. And you're saying before we split, I mean, Julian James is, I think he's saying, before we split into this left brain ego sense, we were much more in touch with the gods or the voices of the gods or the spiritual connection. And then after the split, we became this ego personality. But I think the spiritual evolution that we're moving through is bringing us back beyond that breakdown, back into a bicameral mind. Was that fair to say, or did I lose you in that? I mean,
well, you know, Julian James, unfortunately, the reality of the ancient world is that people took the revelations of their own brains for the voices of the gods, and they said the god commanded this and the god commanded that, and that got people into some very, very interesting authoritarian dilemmas, that the mind was divided into two parts and it was really dissociated. Modern people do have the opportunity to sample both sides of the brain. I mean, you do it in the curriculum when you have math and English literature on the one side, and then over on the other side you have music and the arts, which are really have been traditionally denigrated in American mm-hmm. culture. And then along came John Dewey and William James and said, now wait a minute, if you introduce people to art and music and physical education, they will be more intelligent in the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. You know, but if you only teach reading and writing and arithmetic, and this was the terrible part of this mass testing that took place during the Bush years and No Child Left Behind, I mean, it just terrified everybody by these gigantic mass tests which defined what your knowledge base shall be, instead of allowing your knowledge base to be an organic, scintillating, changing field that changes with what you fall in love with. Mm. I mean, that's the really interesting thing. Those of us, Alan, who are at this stage of our life, know that most of our education has been applying our mind to things that we love. You don't do very well when somebody cracks a whip behind you and says, you will learn about the 30 Years War. We'll learn about the national product of Ecuador. I mean, who cares?
Right.
they force us to learn and digest all kinds of things that we aren't interested in. And you can learn much more when you love the thing that you're interested in. And that's what Campbell was talking about in that Follow Your Bliss Overdone thing.
Right. And in terms of the bicameral mind, I'm just interested in what you think of like what they used to call the New Age or all this channeling stuff where people are now claiming again to hear the voice of God or whatever voice, and some of it is some very high wisdom. Could that be a reunification of left and right brain, or is it something
well,
else?
That would reduce it if you said it was just simply an epiphenomenon of the brain. I think that the brain is a little bit like a radio set or a TV receiver or something like that does pick up transpersonal, timeless, universal sources of wisdom that we don't know where they come from. Does it come from other people's mind? Does it come from outer space or other civilizations that have existed either in the past or currently existing? A lot of the new mythologies have to do with with space travel and aliens involving themselves in human affairs and all that kind of thing. I mean, our whole picture of the universe, I think science fiction has been a wonderful thing in that regard, I must say.
Yes.
I think because we're no longer just restricted to historical narratives with plotting historically known people walking around in the streets of London in the 17th century, but we're out there, treading the Milky Way and the stars and imagining life forms that are different from ourselves. That's been a wonderful thing. Robin is a great fan of science fiction. Do you have something on that, Robin?
I think that science fiction was and fantasy, the two together. First of all, fantasy is the oldest form of human literature. It's not new. It goes all the way back to all the hero stories and the dragon stories and all of those things in all cultures. The stories of magic and amazing adventures and in east of the sun and west of the moon and that kind of thing. Science fiction comes along and sort of springs out of the same magical brew as the great fantasy hero stories, and imagines these things in combination with possibilities for a future, with technological possibilities. But both of them together in the 20th century have created a literature in which people went beyond black and white and class and gender, and you began to see all kinds of strange beings paired off and getting to know each other and trying to understand each other and new looks at who would be the villain and who the hero and just a broadening of all these categories. My father introduced me to the adult side of the public library when I was about 7 years old and loaded me with all kinds of books beyond my so-called reading age. And we had a wonderful time discussing all these things. And right from the start, I was lucky enough in a wonderful poet and sort of a wild thinker of a father to begin to see worlds in which I, as a girl, would be able to do almost anything I could imagine, and in which it didn't matter what race somebody was, because there were probably more races than we could imagine and more types of creatures than we could imagine already out there, and we were going to find them being poets and scientists and thinkers and lovers just as we were and beyond anything we could be. And along with this comes opening ourselves to all of our relations. As we find out more, Stephen and I have spent our lives exploring shamanism and getting back to our own roots there, finding out more about those who share this planet with us that we had sort of shut ourselves off from. So I'll give it back to Steve.
No, I wanted to ask you a question, though, Robin.
Okay.
I just appreciated that because I love science fiction too, and I grew up reading science fiction and being avid Star Trek fan. And then as I was just in Washington last week at the citizens' hearings for UFO disclosure, and this whole idea about aliens and UFOs coming here, I don't think they're just a myth, but I think somehow the being open to science fiction has opened me up to those possibilities. And is there a way to fit that into an actual world, or are those ideas mythic in what they are?
Well, here we have to go back to that 10-year-old boy, because you can't use myth as if it really is a lie, as if it really is a fiction. The myth is something that is true on the inside and only appears to be false on the outside. But I think that the so-called myths of the aliens, back in the late 90s, we went on a number of world journeys with our good friend Dr. John Mack.
Oh, I love John Mack. Yes. Oh, he was a good friend of yours? How nice.
Yes, he was.
Very dear man.
What a great guy.
Very dear man and a very good friend. And he went to the Amazon jungle with us on an incredible journey to Mapia, the holy city of the Santo Daime cult. And we all drank ayahuasca together. And he really wanted to find out if the people of the Amazon had a mythology of alien abduction, and by God, they sure did. They even had pictures of flying saucers and the beings that were in them and all that kind of thing. And I'll never forget, we were also in Australia with John Mack, and he got access to an Aranda clever man that's up in the north of Australia, a shaman, and he had a translator, and he was saying to this Australian Aboriginal, you have a tradition of flying ships, not airplanes, flying ships come from beyond this world, take people up, And the translator is going on, and the clever man looks at him, and he goes, "You mean alien abduction, like on X-Files?" It turned out there was a satellite dish in the next village over.
But that's funny. So I think, though, have been mythicized, but I think they need to be that in order to start to integrate the possibilities of those experiences into a mainstream culture. That's my theory. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. When Robin and I were visiting scholars for the UConn Science Foundation, we found ourselves interacting with Inuit and all the northern tribes, the Kwakiutl, the Bella Coola, the Bella Bella, and we went around lecturing in their schools and being on local, you know, in First Nations TV and all that kind of thing. And one of the main questions we were asked was, what do you know about alien abduction? What do you know about ships from beyond the earth?
Really?
Up there in that vast north country, they were really, really excited about all of that. So it's amazing, these ancient cultures, the whole idea of space travel and other dimensions and all that kind of stuff is not, that's not alien to them.
But I mean, the fact that that's happening, I think, I mean, and they're asking you about it in these ancient cultures, I think a new possibility of a galactic sort of awareness is presenting itself as a new myth to the general mind of humanity. That's what I propose.
I do believe that. And, you know, when we can see ourselves not just as planetary citizens beyond the parochial limits of our local culture, and see ourselves not only as planetary citizens, but as galactic citizens. And do we want to be known as a planet that throws its garbage everywhere and pees in the water and subjects our children to monstrous bombardments of radiation and toxins? Or do we want to be a civilized planet in a civilized universe? I mean, what would we like?
No, I agree. I mean, I'd like to clean up humanity too. But I also want to ask you about the other side of that, the UFO, the actuality, is the Terence McKenna or Carl Jung argument that those ideas are aspects of some projected human consciousness and that they're not real. And, well, I don't agree with that, but how do you deal with that argument about...
I didn't know Terence McKenna personally, although I spent a little bit of time with his brother Dennis. But I mean, he talked constantly about the machine elves and the autonomous creatures that he would see dancing and prancing around the edges of our consciousness. Just alter your consciousness a little bit so you're not seeing the gas station and Sears Roebuck reality anymore, and a machine elf might come, dancing and whirling into your field of consciousness or your field of vision. And the term now is not psychedelic so much as entheogens.
Right.
That they are one or another aspect of God. And I suppose I think those things have really... That's another dimension. I think Robin was saying that it's not only science fiction, but it's fantasy and it's altered states of consciousness, realizing that these separated from us by the filmiest of screens lie these untried forms of consciousness that are just waiting to be explored. And boy, is that humbling. And boy, is that mind opening.
Right. I mean, what was saying, Robin?
Well, I was just going to say that some of the images that are, they're not truly new myths because these have been among first peoples forever, but they're some of the images that are emerging into consciousness of our, into contemporary culture consciousness that you would not have found really recognizable 100 years ago in the West are, for instance, the concept of God incarnate in the vegetable realm. In the Santo Daime, the ayahuasca cult, one aspect aspect of this, of the ayahuasca culture. The idea that the new incarnation of Christ is happening in the vegetable world is not, you know, is not a strange idea. It's just, it's present there. That the Messiah can return to the world in a non-human form. That's a very interesting idea. And a very inclusive idea. It kind of leaves out a lot of the human mishmash. The idea that our whole sense of, for instance, that a tree, in Avatar, a tree can be the divine mother of a planet, or the visual evidence of the divine mother of a planet. This is not so far from what we're learning about mushrooms and possibly the structure of the dark matter in space, the resemblance of these things to our own neurological structures in our brain. These things are intriguing, and they suggest a whole other way of looking at the divine, at consciousness, at what we are.
I think also that's what Terrence McKenna's point is, that these creatures, these ETs, are an aspect of consciousness. If you think they're coming here from another planet in their little spaceships, then you're in trouble. I mean, this is what he said. I think they personally are, but I mean, in a sense, it's both. They are an aspect of consciousness, and we are moving into a new relationship. And I also think, you know, even though you may be I may meet you and you may be a symbolic representation of my mother, whatever, grandmother, but you also exist as yourself. And I think that's the problem we have as symbolic beings, to overlay the other with our projections, but also meet them as the other. Do you know what I mean there?
Yes, the necessity of saying it's either this or that.
Right.
It's too simple.
Right. Right, exactly.
We're back almost to the psychology of Freud and Jung. I don't know that Terrence McKenna believed that. Maybe he did, but there's a famous story.
Yeah, I'll send you a video where he's a Jeffrey Mishlov interview I saw where he talks about that a little bit. But tell me the story that you have to say.
Yeah, there's a famous story of Carlos Castaneda and Fritz Perls at Esalen Institute. And they had both been, everybody had been in the baths, and they were now meeting in one of the halls, and there was a kind of a party going on. And Fritz Perls, the founder of Gestalt psychology, came up to Castaneda, who'd been lecturing, and he said, "Now, Mr. Castaneda, I know you are talking about these spirits and so forth as if they were creatures outside of the human psyche, but we all really know, you and I know, that these are projections, that these are creatures inside the psyche." And Castaneda said, "Oh no, Dr. Perls, you're not going to get me with that one. The spirits really are out there, and they really do have an existence of their own, and they are not just simply aspects of us." And Perl said, "Oh, no, they are inside." And Castaneda said, "Outside, inside, outside." And the argument was punctuated by Perl slapping Castaneda in the face and walking off. And I told that story. I can't remember where I originally heard it, but I was at a gathering in New York, and I was telling the story, and everybody was laughing. And I said, and I was not there myself, and I don't know if it was true or not. And a sepulchral voice behind me said, "But I was there." And I turned around, and it was Michael Harner, who was at the event, and he said, "That is absolutely the way that it went down." And it is one of the great arguments or discussions of our time. Inside, outside. Inside, outside. Do the forms of our dream have an objective existence? Can we fly to other dimensions, other realities in our dream? Are our dreams literally prophecies of things to come, or clairvoyant views of things at a distance? Or are they simply projections of our own turbulent swirling psychodynamic psyches. And that I think that question will not be asked answered in our lifetime.
And to what extent are we going to separate our physical bodies inside our these surface skins from everything around us, as we understand ourselves as energy beings? So does the question of inside and outside still have meaning?
Well, I think that, I mean, at least that's what's changing for me, the fact that we are becoming more obviously energy beings and in a sense a new sacred imagination is being realized in the population, the collective population, does change some of these old arguments, you know?
I think it does. And how anybody can doubt the existence of the so-called paranormal anymore is just, it's kind of beyond me. I taught for many years a course called The Psychology of Consciousness. And as part of that course, I introduced people to psychology as William James would have taught it, in which precognition, mental telepathy are available there all the time, only we don't pay attention to them. Mm-hmm. There's a whole, all the parapsychological literature of the 19th century, you have to ignore that in order to think these things don't exist, or you have to ignore your own intuition when you think of a friend and the phone rings and it's the friend. You know, 3 minutes later, the phone rings and it's this crossover thing. That was very, very important for Mark Twain, mm-hmm. for example. And he proved it many times in his lifetime. He'd be just thinking of somebody and then, you know, a telegram would come or I don't think they had phones in those days, but a letter would arrive, and we live in a world of invisibles. The right now, our voices, your voice is traveling to me invisibly mm-hmm. into my computer, and my voice is traveling to you invisibly. So a thing doesn't exist because it's invisible.
Right, and I think what they're calling it now, and there's a whole resurgence of that, is when what Deepak Chopra is calling is non-locality, that the mind really has this non-local element, and we're seeing that in a sense in the emergence of the new myths of near-death experiences. I call that a cultural myth because it seems to be a taken hold of a certain part of the population as a matter of fact, in a sense, as a truth that we that consciousness survives the body.
And when you travel, and I'm sure you have, Alan. When you travel in other cultures, and I'm thinking particularly of India, Nepal, but also Southeast Asia, Japan, you are exposed, and parts of Australia, New Guinea, New Zealand, the people, the old ways prevail. You find the synchronicities multiply when you live in the technological societies of Northeast North America and Europe. Notice I don't include California. They're so technologically socialized that synchronicities and paranormal things don't exist. But when you're in those other societies, they're happening a mile a minute, these so-called coincidences or synchronicities or people just speaking other people's thoughts. It's happening all the time.
Well, it happens for me in the Northeast, and actually on my computer, I'll get a couple of emails by someone named like Shiloh. Two people from two different parts of the world will email me at the same time with a really unusual name or something. But I know what you mean. Within the left brain mechanistic world, there's no room for that. But that's what, I mean, my whole thing with new realities is trying to globalize an emerging spiritual culture.
Well, I think you're succeeding.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's why the fact that you can get away with this in New York is amazing.
Well, somebody has to do it, you know. I'm like, you know.
It's a tough job, but somebody has to do it.
Well, it's a little piece of the yin inside the yang, you know, a little piece of California inside the New York, so... That's
it's fun. I'm sure it's fun.
It is, and so I mean, there's lots we can say. I look forward to continuing the conversation. This week, is Robin going to come down too with you?
She is usually my sidekick. Every Batman has to have a Robin.
And I'll just call you Batman then.
And I have mine. If you would like her to come, she could come and be interviewed at the same time. I love the things she says.
Well, sure. I mean, it's going to be like a panel discussion, and we'll just throw out a lot of these ideas. But I'd love for her, love for you, Robin, to.
Well, thank you.
To add your flavor.
Yeah, we don't want to make this a gender-skewed dialogue. Well, and
there is going to be a woman named Trisha McCannon on the panel who talks about the new mythologies, and she's real expert in kind of understanding the kind of mystical aspects of the ancient religions, the Egyptian and the Babylonian, and she's a bit of a channeler psychic herself. And then there's this guy named Kevin Sachs, who does a lot of initiations and shamanic transformation. Really nice guy. He's going to be on the panel too. And you and, you know, Robin could be there. And
tell us about this panel. Where do we sit in front of an audience? Or
yeah, hopefully there'll be people coming. And everyone who's listening to this program is also invited to be there at the Meta Center. So there's about, you know, chairs in front of a room, and then there's an audience listening, whoever wants to show up, you know. And
so I will say to the invisible audience, to whom we are synchronistically connected by means of this discussion, mm-hmm. please come. We'd love to see you.
Exactly. Thank you. Thank you. We would love to see you, even if you're invisible. And and at least we'll videotape it so we can have it, you know, at some point on the internet. And so these are some of the ideas I'll throw out, and maybe make it a little more cohesive as we pull different ideas together. But let me just ask you just another question about this. I mean, because I also enjoying your book, The Mythic Imagination, where.
Yes.
You're kind of, I would think you're, I mean, what I get the sense is you are reevaluating the myths in terms of their, how they work in human dramas, you know, and how do we, but the part about conscious myth making, can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I'm wearing down a bit now to get into a whole new topic area,
okay,
but
okay.
I put that book together out of a sample of about 3,000 dreams that I analyzed over 15 years of psychotherapy practice, both for my therapy clients and for my students, and it was a wonderful process of discovery to realize that all of those archetypes, the shadow, the anima, the animus, the living landscape, the lord of the underworld, the spirit guide, that they're all there in people's dreams. We're still dreaming. Our imaginations, if you bother to record your dreams and look at them over a period of about a year, my next book, by the way, is on dreams, and it's called Big Dreams, Little Dreams. Should be out sometime in 2014. And I'm looking at a new psychology of dreaming. We all have to be aware of this. And as we look at our dreams, we find that all of the vast multicolored cast of characters from ancient times to modern times is present in our dreams and narratives and mythic dilemmas.
Wait, so you're saying that our personal dreams have the cast of characters of all the ancient myths. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I see.
And we don't even know it. And Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces starts off with that. A modern guy who is naive to Freudian dynamics, dreams an Oedipal dream, and, you know, kills his father in the dream, and doesn't even know what he's doing. And that's the way the archetypes spring up, you know. Invited or uninvited, the gods are present, said Carl Jung.
Mm. But then one last question. Is it possible that new archetypes are manifesting to the human consciousness as we come to this unity of collectivity, of conscious collectivity, with something like the internet? Can we manifest a new
Well, vision? Possibly so, although I might say that the idea of new archetypes is an oxymoron, because archetypes means old.
Oh, I get it. I get it. Okay.
But there are, Jung would say that there are new inflections, new disguises for very old Platonic forms or archetypes. Are there new archetypes? I think maybe there are new things under the sun. I mean, it is true in Plato's time, people weren't talking about alien abduction, or maybe there are corners of the world in which they were. I don't know.
Zeus was carrying off women all the time. So,
well, maybe it took a different form, exactly. And maybe, in a sense, there is and there isn't anything new under the sun. But
Before we sign off, yes. Alan, I'm going to be coming from a whole day of seeing patients in New York City, and I'm going to be jumping in a cab or a car and coming down to the Lower East Side, and we're starting right at 7 o'clock.
It's not the Lower East Side. It's, and everyone who's listening, it's 214 West 29th Street. 214
West 29th. You're not very far away. I'm going to be on 19 West 34th. So.
Okay, and it's on the 16th floor. I mean, what time can you get there?
I'm going to try and make it there by 7.
Okay, I'll wait for you. We won't start without you. And
You can start as much as you want without me.
No. We'll wait for you. And also would love to come and visit you sometime up at your Stone Mountain. Is that Stone?
Please.
Yes, we'd be delighted to have you come. We had a wonderful Beltane festival this year, and then another thing called the Forest Fest. And we're looking forward probably to a nice midsummer festival. Well, I'm not quite sure what we're going to do yet at midsummer on Lugnasund, the end of July at Center for Symbolic Studies. But look at symbolicstudies.org, or my clinical website is stonemountaincenter.com, where I work on people with brain injuries and psychiatric disorders and help them without drugs.
You help them by using a machine that kind of balances the left and right side of the brain? Is that what you're...
Well, by doing neurofeedback and biofeedback,
and a few
other techniques of, and I do work with dreams.
And I also want to say you're the author of The Shaman's Doorway, The Mythic Imagination, Fire in the Mind, The Life of Joseph Campbell with Robin, and The Healing Power of Neurofeedback, The Revolutionary of the LENS Technique. That sounds interesting.
Yep.
We should do a whole show about that.
We could possibly do a show on neurofeedback.
We'll talk about that. Lots of things to look forward to. Thank you both for just playing with a few ideas and not coming to any conclusions. That's fine.
Thanks for having us.
Well, it's been fun. I love hearing about Joseph Campbell too. He's become a myth. Isn't that ironic?
he's a legend in his own time, for sure.
Definitely is. Okay, I look forward to seeing you Thursday night, May 16th. That's Stephen Larson at a panel discussion at the Meta Center. Thanks for tuning in.
And the Meta Center is 214
West 29th Street on the 16th floor in New York City, Manhattan, between 7th and 8th Avenue, right there. Not far from Madison Square Garden. So
we're very close in there.
All right, great. So I'll see you then.
All right.
This is Alan Stein.
Thanks, Alan.
Thanks, guys. Thank you very much. I'll just sign.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah, talk to you. This is Alan Steinfeld. Let me see if I can disconnect those guys. Thank you. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. You've been listening to my interview with Stephen and Robin Larson as I was saying, they're going to be part of the discussion coming up this Thursday in New York City on the, what do I call it? The creation of new cultural mythologies, where we're going into a new time of the unknown, in a sense. What are the new stories that we need to tell in order to integrate a very divergent planet, a planet moving in many different directions? How can we create a new myth that will bring us together to create a new civilization? That's really what the undercurrent of this discussion will be. And if you want to know more about that, you can tune into my website at newrealities.com. You can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. And I look forward to hearing from people. Any ideas or questions, please send it my way. Thanks for listening tonight. Good night.